All right, so I'm not sure how much, I guess this is a week of olfaction, and what I was going to do is tell you a little bit about some of the work that I've been doing, and hopefully some work of others that I will squeeze in here on some of the mechanisms of synaptic transmission in the olfactory bulb, which is the first place in the brain where olfactory information is processed in mammals. And probably the first person to really appreciate the beauty of the olfactory bulb was the great neurohistologist Ramon y Cajal. And this slide is actually one of his original sketches of the olfactory bulb, and I show it for a few reasons. The first thing is, as you can see by the arrows here, even Ramon y Cajal knew the importance of whiteout because he could change the direction of his arrows depending on how he wanted to go. But the other thing is that the olfactory bulb shown here has quite a remarkable structure, so that just briefly, information comes from olfactory receptor cells in the nose, and these olfactory receptor cells send axons onto the distal dendritic tufts of the principal cells of the olfactory bulb called mitral cells. Mitral cells then project axons generally through the olfactory bulb and the lateral olfactory tract onto higher centers like the piriform cortex. Now, within the olfactory bulb, these connections from the olfactory nerve endings onto these distal dendrites of the mitral cells actually form these very dense regions of neuropil that are somewhat like barrels in the somatosensory cortex. In this case, they're called glomeruli. So if that's the principal connection, the other main cell of the olfactory bulb that we'll be focused on in this talk as well are called granule cells. And granule cells have a couple of interesting features. First of all, they lack any morphologically identifiable axon. They are axonless neurons. However, these granule cells also have fairly extensive dendrites, both in sort of their basal region here, and they also have dendrites which commingle with lateral dendrites of the mitral cells. And the dendrites of these granule cells, these local interneurons, are quite unusual in that they have very large dendritic spines, which are maybe 5 to 10 times larger than many of the spines you might be familiar with from pyramidal cells in the cortex, for example. So this is just sort of brief schematic of Ramon y Cajal's picture, just to point out some of the main features again in this sort of laminar structure. And so that is that information first comes in from the olfactory nerve fibers into these discrete glomeruli, where the distal dendritic tufts of the mitral cells lie. And probably, as some of you know, there's been a lot of interest recently in the olfactory bulb of mammals that really probably started around 10 years ago when Linda Buck and Richard Axel first cloned the receptors, the olfactory receptors themselves that are in the olfactory receptor cells in the nose. And what's really come from that work in the past 10 years or so is the idea that the sort of mapping of information in the olfactory bulb essentially comes in as sort of labeled lines, and that's because olfactory receptor cells in the nose only express one of about 1,000 different types of olfactory receptors. And the axons of olfactory receptor cells that express a unique receptor map onto one discrete glomerulus, or a couple discrete glomeruli. And so this has sort of led to the idea that glomeruli represent a spatial map of odor detection. And just to give you some of their original data, it was really derived from molecular biological approaches. And in this case, this is work from Richard Axel's lab, along with Peter Mombertz and Catherine Dulac and Linda Buck. But what they did was create transgenic mice in which the cells that express a unique type of olfactory receptor, which just has a name like P2 in this case, are also expressing a marker. So you can label the cells in the axons that express that unique receptor. So this is just a picture of the nasal epithelium in the nose, and all these little dots are individual olfactory receptor cells that express a unique type of olfactory receptor. And the main point here, if we look in this slide, this is actually showing the axons of the olfactory receptor cells as they come through the cribriform plate, which is the base of the skull, and showing that the axons converge onto what seems to be a single glomerulus in the olfactory bulb. And that's probably shown a little bit better here, maybe. Again, the same sort of mouse that was created so that all of the cells that express the P2 type of olfactory receptor all show up here as dots in the olfactory epithelium. And now if we look over here, these are actually pictures of the olfactory bulb. And let's see. In this slide, actually, what they're doing is looking at an in situ hybridization, I think, showing you the mRNA that can actually be detected in the axons of olfactory receptor cells. And in this case, the P2 gene product, or the mRNA for the P2 receptor, only seems to light up one individual glomerulus in each of the two olfactory bulbs. And that's shown here at higher gain. And then also just showing this marker that's used to also visualize the axons. So the idea that came from this, really, that was put forth, is that glomeruli sort of play a very important role in shaping how olfactory information is decoded. And to sort of take it a bit further, a lot of recent work from people that are now using intrinsic imaging techniques in vivo, and this is work from Larry Katz and Marcus Meister and Tobias Bonhoeffer, have started to look at the activity of glomeruli in living rats or mice, in this case using intrinsic signal imaging, where they can actually study regions of activity in the olfactory bulb. So what's shown here is actually an olfactory bulb in a rat or a mouse, I guess. And they're looking at the signals that can be derived from measuring activity in the olfactory bulb in response to several different odorants, in this case, amyl acetate, which is a common one, peanut butter, and then carvone. And the main point is that you just tend to see discrete patterns of glomerular activity in the olfactory bulb, sort of in line with this molecular work that I just showed you. And then what's shown here is that one can also see sort of dose-dependent behavior in the olfactory bulb, so that if one starts out with a very low concentration of an odorant, you see perhaps, you know, one or two glomeruli becoming activated. And then as you increase the concentration of the odorant, it seems that more glomeruli are activated in the olfactory bulb, which sort of fits some of the work that was done recently as well, sort of trying to explain that the processing of olfactory information is perhaps a combinatorial process of activating discrete subsets of glomeruli in the mitral cells that underlie them. So while that sort of fits in well with this idea that the glomeruli are perhaps a spatial map for odor detection, one of the things about the olfactory bulb that I wanted to talk about today are actually synaptic interactions within the olfactory bulb, so that in addition to these mitral cells, which receive the input from the olfactory nerve, and just for the sake of giving numbers, it's thought that about 25 mitral cells innervate one single glomerulus. And within the olfactory bulb, this class of interneurons, the granule cells, has been suggested to play an important role in the processing of information in the bulb. And that's because granule cells are generally thought to be GABAergic interneurons and work from, dating back to the 1960s, has really sort of established that there are actually synaptic contacts between the lateral dendrites of mitral cells and the dendritic spines of granule cells, which give rise to a dendrodendritic circuit for synaptic transmission in the bulb. And the best way to show this dendrodendritic synapse is just to give you a sense of what it looks like at the EM level. So shown on the bottom here is a mitral cell dendrite, and shown on the top is a granule cell spine. Now, while we often think of dendritic spines as purely postsynaptic structures in the brain, the first thing that you can see is that the granule cell spine is actually chock full of synaptic vesicles, and they cluster around a potential release site in the granule cell spine. And what you can see in the mitral cell dendrite is that there's also a gathering of synaptic vesicles opposed to a postsynaptic density. And this sort of gave rise to the idea that there is actually a reciprocal synaptic circuit between these the dendrites of these two cell types. And in fact, this sort of EM micrograph, or this sort of picture of what you see at one of these synaptic contacts, isn't just a it isn't just a fluke of taking one section, because there's been a lot of serial reconstruction studies of the contacts between mitral and granule cell dendrites, and virtually all of these synaptic contacts have this reciprocal pattern. So what might this reciprocal pattern do? Well, it was generally thought up until a few years ago that this is really what was understood about the circuit, and that would be that mitral cell dendrites are excitatory and release the excitatory transmitter glutamate, which would excite the spines of granule cells, and this in turn would trigger a release of the inhibitory transmitter GABA back onto the mitral cell dendrite. So just some of the work I want to go over briefly. Some of the work that we and others have done to try and understand some of the mechanisms governing transmission in this dendrodendritic circuit. So a lot of the experiments I'll tell you about today have actually been done in brain slices of the rat olfactory bulb using patch clamp recording techniques. And it doesn't come up too well here, but this is just a picture of a living brain slice, and the point from this is that you can actually make out those discrete layers that I showed you before, and you can even visualize these individual glomeruli, which don't show up well here. So if I cheat and just draw some circles on them, I'll tell you that these are the glomeruli. The mitral cells sit in their own unique layer. This is that dendrodendritic region where the dendrites of mitral and granule cells all interact. What is what? This stands for the external plexiform layer. So that's just a name for where the dendrites of the mitral and granule cells tend to lie. So the first things that we wanted to do was just establish that this dendrodendritic circuit actually exists in the rat olfactory bulb. And to do that, we just actually did a simple experiment like this. This is a current clamp recording from a visually identified mitral cell in a rat olfactory bulb slice. And what's shown here is the response of a mitral cell to a very brief depolarizing current injection. And what happens is the cell fires a barrage of action potentials. And as you can see, at the end of the current injection, there's this somewhat long-lasting after hyperpolarization. Shown in the middle panel is the response of the same cell after we apply tetrodotoxin to block sodium-dependent action potentials and presumably block the ability of any axon to convey information. And we also add a little bit of TEA to block potassium channels. And what happens under these conditions when we give a small current injection is that we actually generate a calcium spike in the mitral cell. And as you can see, that's still followed by this bumpy looking after hyperpolarization. And shown in the right-hand panel is the response of the same cell after we apply bicuculine, which is a GABA-A receptor antagonist. And as you can see, that completely abolishes this after hyperpolarization that's recorded in the mitral cell.
That's still a TKCA.
Yeah. So the simplest explanation from these sorts of results is that since we're recording generally a synaptic response in the absence of sodium-dependent action potentials, presumably this calcium spike in the dendrites is causing activation of this reciprocal synaptic circuit, and it's mediated by GABA-A type GABA receptors. So we then moved on to study this circuit using voltage clamp recording so we could study synaptic currents. And this is just an example of what this dendrodendritic inhibition looks like in voltage clamp. In most of these experiments, we use a chloride-containing internal solution, so any inhibitory postsynaptic current will look like a downward deflection. So this is a response shown here from a single mitral cell in voltage clamp. We hold the cell at minus 70 millivolts and then give a brief step to 0 millivolts. And what that does is essentially activate a lot of sodium and some calcium current. And what you can see is that at the end of the step, when we go back to minus 70 millivolts, there's a sort of a very long-lasting barrage of synaptic events here. Well, shown on the right is the same cell after we apply it to tetrodotoxin, again to block sodium-dependent action potentials. And now we give a voltage step. We've made it a little bit longer in this case, so we actually get a nice calcium current, which you can barely make out here. And as you can see, even in the presence of tetrodotoxin to block all action potentials in the slice, we still see this long-lasting barrage of synaptic events, which is actually just sort of expanded here on a time scale to show you those unitary synaptic currents that give rise to that slow tail of synaptic activity. So the next question was first just to confirm a lot of the pharmacology that I showed you about in the beginning. In some of the next examples I'm going to show, we simply blanked out the response to the initial voltage step so we could show this dendrodendritic synaptic response more clearly. This is a voltage clamp recording, again, from a mitral cell. Under control conditions, when we give a depolarizing voltage step, we see this barrage of synaptic events. They're abolished by bicuculine, that GABA-A receptor antagonist. And then shown below, I think the same cell after washing out the bicuculine, when we add cadmium, which is a non-selective voltage-gated calcium channel antagonist, that also abolishes this dendrodendritic response. So these experiments indicate that this dendrodendritic circuit not only requires GABA-A receptors, but also requires voltage-dependent calcium channels. So the next thing we wanted to know was what is the nature of the glutamate receptors on the granule cell spines that are important for triggering this release of GABA? And as most of you know, there are generally two main classes of glutamate receptors that are important for synaptic transmission in the brain, the AMPA receptors and the NMDA receptors. So, AMPA receptors typically have fairly rapid kinetics. They mediate the bulk of excitatory synaptic transmission in the brain, whereas NMDA receptors have a number of interesting properties. They're highly permeable to calcium ions. They're blocked in a voltage-dependent fashion by extracellular magnesium ions, and they have intrinsically slow kinetics. So this just shows our first experiments trying to look at the pharmacology of what glutamate receptors might be important on the granule cell spine. In this case, we quantified dendrodendritic inhibition simply by integrating the current following the voltage step here to measure that synaptic activity. And what's shown here is that when we applied the AMPA receptor antagonist DNQX, it pretty much abolished dendrodendritic transmission. So this sort of fit in with the thinking that AMPA receptors would be important on the granule cell for triggering GABA release. So we were somewhat surprised then when in a separate series of experiments, we looked at the role of NMDA receptors using the specific antagonist APV. And what we found was that APV also caused a fairly dramatic reduction in this dendrodendritic transmission. So this was sort of puzzling to us to think that the two receptors both would be sort of equally important until we started to think that maybe this was telling us something about how the two receptor types have often been suggested to work at synaptic contacts. And that is, one could argue that perhaps NMDA receptors are especially good at triggering GABA release from the spines of granule cells. But if the two receptor types are co-localized at the same synapse, then it's quite possible that AMPA receptors are required at the dendritic spine of granule cells to give the initial depolarization to the spine, to remove that magnesium block of the NMDA receptors, to allow the NMDA receptors to do their thing. So if this was true, that actually the AMPA receptors were co-localizing with the NMDA receptors and they were just important for providing depolarization to let the NMDA receptors work, then it should be possible to drive this dendrodendritic circuit entirely by NMDA receptors. And the way to think about doing that is just to take away all the extracellular magnesium. So now you don't need the AMPA receptors, presumably, to depolarize those spines. So shown here is just, again, dendrodendritic inhibition in a voltage clamp mitral cell under control conditions. And then after we've taken away the magnesium that's bathing the slice, and what you can see is that there's a large increase in this dendrodendritic response, which sort of fits with the idea that NMDA receptors are playing an important role.
I talk about inhibition or excitation.
Am I talking about inhibition or excitation? See, I normally have a second little thing here. We're always talking about two synapses that are working in series with one another. So the mitral cell releases glutamate onto the granule cell spine. The granule cell releases GABA back onto the mitral cell, and what we're measuring is the GABA response in the mitral cell. All right, so we're trying to get at what's happening on that granule cell spine somewhat indirectly.
And this is because you get the pressure from the granule cell
directly? I'll get to that, and I'll show you some of that in a second.
But assuming then that inhibition is just directly like proportional or scales with the degree of excitation to the granule cell.
Presumably, yes, for now, right. So shown here is the response, just doing the pharmacology. Again, we start off in control conditions. We're measuring dendrodendritic inhibition. We wash out the magnesium. The response gets much larger. And now in the absence of magnesium, as I showed you before, APV, the NMDA receptor antagonist, pretty much abolishes the dendrodendritic response. However, now after washing out the APV, when we try the AMPA receptor antagonist, it essentially has no effect. So this sort of fits in with the idea that NMDA receptors are especially good at driving the GABA release back onto the mitral cell. And so just to confirm the properties of the receptors that mediate transmission between mitral and granule cells, we did paired recordings of voltage clamping a mitral cell and voltage clamping a nearby granule cell. And shown here is sort of a typical sort of response. All these experiments are done in tetrodotoxin, so that we're only looking at dendrodendritic transmission. We give a voltage step to the mitral cell, and this is all in the presence of GABA-A antagonists as well. And this is sort of the synaptic response we record in the granule cell. I believe this is done under sort of low magnesium conditions. Under controlled conditions, when we give a stimulus to the mitral cell, we see a fast excitatory current that has a both a fast and a slow component to its decay time course. This fast component is abolished by the AMPA receptor antagonist NBQX, and the remaining slow component is abolished by the NMDA receptor antagonist APV. If we just do a sort of digital subtraction of the synaptic current onto the granule cell, do a subtraction of the response in NBQX from control, we can look at the AMPA receptor-mediated synaptic current in isolation. And as you can see, it has the typical fast kinetics that are seen in most synaptic contacts. We looked at the current voltage relationship of the AMPA receptors and found that it was essentially linear and reversed at 0 millivolts, which is consistent with the sort of AMPA receptors that contain this GluR2 subunit, meaning that these AMPA receptors are not calcium permeable. And then finally, just another little bit of pharmacology, we showed that cyclothiazide, which is a drug that is very effective at slowing the kinetics of AMPA receptors, caused a marked increase in the decay time course of the AMPA receptor current here. So,
why did you have was it just to make absolutely sure things were clean, but why did you have to have the gamma block?
There are several. One main reason is that the granule cells receive inhibitory synaptic contact. So there are a lot of spontaneous GABA events that one records in a granule cell, and that was essentially just to make it all somewhat cleaner. So there are a few things to take from this right away, and that is that the time course of this NMDA synaptic current that's generated in the granule cell is quite slow. In fact, it looks like it has a time course that's very similar to the time course of that slow barrage of inhibitory synaptic currents that we measure. And so that sort of raises the question of perhaps a calcium influx through the NMDA receptor in those granule cell spines is actually the trigger for GABA release in this dendrodendritic circuit. And we thought about that for some time, and there's been recent work from the labs of Ben Strobridge and Gordon Shepherd's lab, which have in fact suggested that under some conditions you can drive GABA release from the granule spines purely by calcium influx through the NMDA receptor. Those experiments were all done generally in low magnesium ringer, which really facilitates the role of any NMDA receptor in this circuit. And we decided to sort of look at that same question under more physiological conditions. And for us, physiological is generally normal, our normal extracellular magnesium concentration of like 1.5 millimolar and a temperature of about 32 or 33 degrees. And the question we wanted to get at is whether or not the NMDA receptors were essentially required, or are they the only receptor that can actually drive GABA release from those dendritic spines. And to do that, we did a couple of different tricks. The first was we started off in normal extracellular magnesium studying dendrodendritic inhibition. We then put on the NMDA receptor antagonist APV, which pretty much abolished all of this dendrodendritic circuit. And then we took advantage of that drug, cyclothiazide, that I showed you before, which dramatically slows the kinetics of AMPA receptors. And what we found under these conditions is that cyclothiazide essentially restored dendrodendritic inhibition. And in fact, it looked identical to that under control conditions. And now this response was completely mediated by AMPA receptor activity in the granule cell dendrites. And then shown on the right, another sort of trick that we tried, the same experiment again, dendrodendritic inhibition under control conditions. We block the NMDA receptors and make most of the response go away. And now if we just sort of tickle the granule cells a little bit, just increase their excitability with a little bit of TEA, which is a potassium channel blocker, and 4-aminopyridine, which is another potassium channel blocker. We found that we could also restore dendrodendritic inhibition by increasing the excitability of the granule cells. And now that response was also entirely mediated by AMPA receptors. So these experiments suggested to us that it's not that you absolutely need the NMDA receptors to trigger GABA release, although they're quite effective normally at doing it. You can drive dendrodendritic inhibition with AMPA receptors. And that sort of begs the question of why is it normally that NMDA receptors are especially good at driving GABA release from the spine? And probably the simplest idea is that the big difference between AMPA receptors and NMDA receptors is that NMDA receptors have very slow kinetics. So part of the work that's come from these experiments is that it's actually the kinetics of the synaptic current rather than the actual type of receptor that's mediating the response that is actually very important for whether or not you can trigger GABA release. So what's so special about the kinetics of the synaptic current that would make that possible? Well, it seems to us that the most likely scenario is that perhaps you need, the synaptic current has to be somewhat slow to be able to bring, let's say, the granule cell spines to threshold for activating a voltage-dependent calcium channel, which ultimately triggers GABA release from those spines. And so we then just wanted to look at whether or not voltage-gated calcium channels could trigger GABA release in these spines. And in these experiments, we're recording from a mitral cell again and voltage clamp, and now we use a little puffer pipette with high potassium to cause a local depolarization of those granule cell spines. And what's shown here is a response in a mitral cell, again giving our typical voltage step. We see this long-lasting flurry of synaptic currents. And then shown down below here is the response in the same cell. We just give this little puff of high potassium in the dendrites. And as you can see, we also get this long-lasting barrage of synaptic currents, which looks quite similar to what we get when we just directly drive a single mitral cell. Well, shown here is a response in the same cell after we've abolished all the glutamate receptors in this circuit, which, as we would expect, since it blocks any of the communication between the mitral and the granule cell, blocks dendrodendritic inhibition. However, as you can see down below, the response to that local depolarization of the dendrites is still there, and then that's abolished by the subsequent application of cadmium, which is a...
Let me be selfish for a moment. How do you avoid the direct depolarization of the mitral cell in this experiment? Presumably, both dendrites will be depolarized, and that would produce an inward current, and since you manipulated your chloride to make it look like an inward current, I'm just wondering how you separate those two things in that bottom left panel.
No, I know what you're saying, and all I would say is that generally we don't get, I think it's primarily from trying to puff a little bit farther away. Mm-hmm. And I would probably say there could be a very small component here of direct depolarization, but actually in experiments that I haven't shown, bicuculine pretty much abolishes most of this thing. So it's
I can see a lot of them.
Yeah.
The sharp stuff.
Right, and that's what we were most interested in. So these experiments suggest that there are voltage-gated calcium channels on the spines of granule cells, and they are sufficient to trigger GABA release. But the question then is that what's normally operating when this reciprocal circuit works? And the obvious problem with trying to probe the role of voltage-gated calcium channels in this circuit is that if you put on a calcium channel blocker to try and study release from the granule cell dendrite, you will at the same time block transmission from the mitral cell, which presumably requires voltage-gated calcium channels to set off this whole sort of chain reaction. So to get around that, we use caged calcium inside our patch pipettes and filled the mitral cell dendrites with caged calcium, which we could then photolyze with a UV flash and trigger glutamate release from the mitral cell dendrite in the absence of any need for calcium channels in the mitral cell. So this again is another voltage clamp recording of a mitral cell. We give the voltage step to the mitral cell, see that dendrite dendritic response. This is the response of the same cell, except now we just use a little UV flash onto the mitral cell, which causes this barrage of synaptic events that looks just like what we would get if we trigger glutamate release with a calcium current. And the cells or the responses have the same sort of pharmacology. The NMDA receptor antagonist blocks both the voltage step response and the flash response, sort of suggesting that it's all working as we had hoped. And so the experiment really is just shown here. And that was to use cadmium to block voltage-gated calcium channels under conditions. In this case, we alternate a voltage step to the mitral cell with a flash. And as you can see, the cadmium blocks both responses sort of in parallel, suggesting that actually voltage-gated calcium channels on the granule cell spines under sort of normal conditions actually play a very important role in releasing GABA for this dendrite-dendritic circuit.
Yeah, if you go back to the last one, there's so much richness here. You've got this long-lasting barrage of iPSCs, and you gave a brief UV flash.
Yes.
How much cage did you have in the cell?
How much cage did we have in the cell? I think it's 2 millimolar.
So it's a couple of millimolar.
Yeah.
It's just surprising to synaptic physiology, right? To see this long-lasting, continued release at rates that are very high. I mean, they're a significant proportion of the peak rate of release going on for a long period of time. Presumably, calcium's come back down a long way.
Right. So the big question, which I haven't gotten to, I think, yet in this talk, and don't think I will either, is what governs this slow time course of dendrite-dendritic inhibition, right? So what I've shown you before is that, an NMDA receptor, let's say, the decay time constant of an NMDA receptor under our conditions of a synaptic current decays on the order of, with a time constant of about 100 milliseconds or so. The time constant of decay for this dendrite-dendritic circuit is actually much slower. It's on the order of 250 milliseconds. So one of the big questions is why you get such a long-lasting recurrent inhibition. And no one's tested this directly, to my knowledge. And what I would say as well is that the flash response is doing the same thing as the glutamate, and that is from the pair recordings that we've done, we know if you just stimulate a mitral cell, you don't get this long-lasting glutamate release onto a granule cell. It actually looks quite similar to any other synaptic current that you would get. So it's not that the slow time course of this dendrite-dendritic inhibition is due to a very slow release of glutamate. So most likely what's setting the time course is something that's happening in the granule cell. And I can give you a couple of possibilities. If you wanted to be more diabolical, you could say, well, maybe the calcium sensitivity of the release apparatus in the granule cell spine is somewhat unusual. And it has a very high affinity for calcium, some variant of synaptotagmin in there that's different. An alternative, which I think is much more likely, is that the slow time course actually reflects some recurrent activity in the granule cell dendrites and spines, like a recurrent calcium spike, right? And I think I might have something coming up on that. I'm not sure. We can use that. One argument that I would make, let's see if this fits the argument. Well, I'll just tell you what this experiment is first. This is just actually looking at the unitary events that underlie dendritic inhibition. What we did next was actually just look at the amplitudes of these individual events that make up the dendrite-dendritic response. And that's plotted in this experiment. This is just a cumulative frequency plot showing the amplitudes for those unitary synaptic currents that are evoked with the voltage step or evoked with that UV flash. Both of them are essentially identical, which sort of fits with the idea that the flash is doing the same thing as the voltage step. And then shown here, this curve is actually the size of the unitary events in the presence of cadmium. And as it's typically been argued in other systems, recording spontaneous synaptic events in cadmium are thought to reflect the quantal events or the single vesicle events that occur when a vesicle spontaneously fuses at a nerve terminal. And what I've done here is just superimpose an average of the unitary events that are evoked with a voltage step and compared that to the amplitude of these single quantal events that one can record in the same cell. And it just turns out that on average, in a number of cells that we've looked at, the evoked responses are often on the order of 3 to 4 times the single quantal size. So one thing that I would argue is that very often those events that underlie dendrodendritic inhibition are essentially synchronous release of several vesicles. And to me, the simplest explanation for that is that dendrodendritic inhibition is often due to the fact that you activate several granule cell spines that contact one mitral cell. And
This actually fits with this has been looked at carefully since the 70s, the number of spines per mitral cell dendrite. I mean, our data is very old on this.
Right, so we're starting to do that now with some, you know, paired recordings and doing a quantal analysis. And you're right, and that no one, as far as I can tell, there are no hard numbers on the number of contacts an individual granule cell makes with an individual mitral cell. We know that just from the numbers, there are about, 50 to 100 granule cells for each mitral cell, and on the order of 3 to 4 contacts or 3 to 5 contacts. So this is sort of consistent with some of that. So again, I think what's happening during that dendrodendritic inhibition, you know, and this is just my bias, whereas you know, people like Ben Strobridge and Gordon Shepherd might tell you that, you know, it's all due to calcium influx locally at a granule cell spine, which triggers GABA release. I'm sort of the thinking that glutamate excites a granule cell to threshold for activating a voltage-gated calcium current or a potential, all right? And now, most likely to me, there's some sort of recurrent signal that propagates through the dendrites, all right? And that can go on for some time. And we're actively looking at that. So just to make a little shift here, yeah.
What's your sense of what the size of the spines has to do with it? I mean, are there a region that you can test for the size of the spines are smaller? Or larger, or can you genetically modify the animals so that the granule cells have different size spines?
I don't know how you could genetically modify an animal to have different spines. I'm not sure what the, you know, how the spine volume actually fits in with this. You know, again, in my mind, I think of these spines as ginormous, just huge structures compared to other spines. There has been work recently at the EM level, just trying to look at the nature of the receptors on the spine and where they're located. So, for example, it turns out that the GABA receptors, and this is just using immuno-EM labeling of receptors, the GABA receptors are very well isolated, you know, on the granule cell spine from the NMDA and the AMPA receptors, right? And I'm trying to think what I was trying to say. And it also seems to be that the NMDA receptors are not scattered willy-nilly over this giant spine. They're fairly well concentrated, immediately opposed from the site of glutamate release. So there, you could make some arguments just sort of on the dimensions and the shape of the spine about what sort of what would be the local calcium transient, for example, that a spine would see when an NMDA receptor opens. And Kerry is probably much more of an expert on something like that. I mean, I'm pretty old-fashioned, I guess, and I tend to think that transmitter release generally requires a very high local concentration of calcium on the order of 100 micromolar, you know, a little bit lower, depends where you think, but many micromolar of calcium at the exocytotic apparatus. So one question that comes to mind, if you have a very large spine is it even possible that the calcium that would come in through an NMDA receptor would reach a high concentration, you know, some far away, on the order of a micron away, let's say? And I tend to look at some of that anatomy and the size of the spine and actually would say that that doesn't fit with a role for calcium influx through an NMDA receptor being able to trigger transmitter release. Although there are recent studies from Nair's group and Sackman's group looking at this giant calyx synapse in the auditory system, again using flash photolysis of caged calcium and measuring the concentration of calcium in a nerve terminal, and they would claim that actually the sensitivity of release machinery to calcium is much higher than has been previously estimated in other systems. So it's a little bit up in the air.
10 micromolar. They're talking 20 micromolar, 10 to 20 micromolar for an effective affinity.
Right.
20 micromolar, that's a huge amount.
Right. So I'm sort of old-fashioned in the sense that I generally like the model where exocytosis comes about because you have release machinery, vesicles, and so forth, intimately opposed to a voltage-gated calcium channel. So you get a very high local concentration that's all due to location and having everything close together. So, you know, the fact that you have this giant spine with NMDA receptors over here and the release machinery over here makes it unlikely for me that that calcium influx through an NMDA receptor would be able to reach sufficiently high concentrations to trigger GABA release, although I guess some would argue not. All right, so I just want to sort of move forward a little bit and talk about why we're even talking about dendrodendritic synapses here in the first place, which I should have mentioned. And that is that the issue is what do these synapses do for information processing in the olfactory bulb? And so there are a couple of possibilities. One is that these sort of dendrodendritic circuits that I'm talking about are only important for self-inhibition, and that would be the case where a mitral cell excites a granule cell spine, and that spine directly leads back to an inhibition of that mitral cell, a very nice and secure pathway for feedback inhibition. However, another possibility, which really comes from the anatomy more than anything else, is that this dendrodendritic circuit is very important for lateral inhibition, very much like inhibition in the retina. Lateral inhibition in the retina might be important for sharpening the detection of visual information. And the lateral inhibition would come about because a mitral cell could excite a single granule cell. And the dendrites of a single granule cell can contact multiple mitral cells. So you can imagine a single mitral cell exciting a granule cell, which causes feedback inhibition, but also causes the inhibition of a mitral cell which did not drive that granule cell.
The granule cells are spiking.
The granule cells are spiking cells. They can spike. They don't have an axon, but they have sodium-dependent action potentials.
On the dendrite.
In the dendrites,
the dendrite,
yes. Yes. Yes.
And the voltage changes, like how electrotonically compact.
How electrotonically compact? I tend to think of the granule cells as very electrotonically compact. All right, they're very tiny cells. They have a very high input resistance when you you know, record from them. They're very tight little cells. There hasn't been a lot, as far as I know, that's been published yet on the actual active properties of the granule cell dendrites. Certainly, you know, if you record from one electrically, you see action potentials. And if you put a dye in the cell, which I don't know who else has done besides me or others, you, maybe Sackman, you can record calcium transients in the far dendrites of the granule cell. So certainly they have very active dendrites, even though they have no axon.
In frog, they have a very high threshold. It's hard to bring the threshold.
The granule cells in mammals that I've seen actually they sit at very negative resting potentials, you know, like minus 70 or something like that, or maybe even lower. Their thresholds seem to be about the same to me that I've seen in other systems, you know, minus 55, something like that.
Do you see multiple amplitude spikes in the granule cells?
Multiple amplitude spikes.
Yeah, something that would suggest you're sitting in the cell, but something that might suggest that there were spikes originating in many places.
And oh, I see what you're saying.
Size, certainly in the frog, you see that.
Yeah, we.
Also, in which cell?
in the granule cells.
In the granule cells of frogs, you see many
more than one spike initiation therapy.
Well, that would be an argument for it. That's what I'm asking.
Yeah, I haven't done a lot. I mean, that would be something to look at. I mean, I would probably say yes. I haven't done a lot of current clamp recordings from the granule cell, so I can't tell you yet. I mean, if you just give a current injection in the soma, you know, I wouldn't say that you see quite a variability in the size of the spikes, but probably what you'd want to do is stimulate out on a dendrite in different regions and see if the spikes look different depending on where you're
I'm just asking because that bears on this question, right? Because with soma inhibition, you can imagine it's a local... well, even in the case of self inhibition, does there have to be an action potential for that reciprocal percent to go?
What I've shown you up to now is that actually you get this whole circuit in the absence of any sodium-dependent action potential.
But you've been giving big clamp sets.
Right. In the mitral cell. But I'm just saying that, you know, it doesn't... It certainly doesn't need a sodium-dependent action potential in a granule cell to cause this whole circuit, right? And you're right. I mean, a lot of the stuff that I've been talking about is very mechanistic, and it's not saying what's happening normally when the thing is spiking. And
then the question of how if one spine got excited, then how would that propagate to another spine to cause inhibition? For this lateral right.
Well, I'm going to get to that right now. I'll just get to that in a second. Just a quick thing. So just to sort of show you what these, why this dendrite-dendritic circuit is thought to be important for odor discrimination, I think this still stands as sort of the classic study from Kensaku Mori, who recorded from the rabbit olfactory bulb in vivo, recorded extracellular unit activity of mitral cells, and then let the rabbit take a whiff of different odorants that were all very highly related. So he looked at a series of aliphatic aldehydes, which are essentially very similar molecules, except they just differ by one carbon on their chain length, all right? And so this is the response of a single mitral cell, shown down below here as sort of the respiratory pattern of the rabbit. And during this little period marked by the bar, they give the odor. So the first thing that you can see is that there's sort of this ongoing respiratory rhythm all the time in the mitral cells. They fire off a few spikes whenever there's an inspiration. If we look over here, you can see that the response of this mitral cell to the 6 or the 7 carbon aldehyde actually sort of strongly excited the mitral cell. However, if you just look, you know, going from the 7 carbon to the 8 carbon, it actually causes a profound suppression of the firing activity in that mitral cell, as well as the other compounds sort of bracketing those molecules. And that's also shown down here. In another cell, the 5 carbon chain length excites the cell, the 6 and the 7 strongly inhibit it. And then to try and tie this in with some of the work that I've shown and that others have done, this is the response of another mitral cell in their control conditions when they found one odorant that caused a sharp inhibition of the firing in that cell. That inhibition was removed when they locally applied a glutamate receptor antagonist into this region of dendrite-dendritic synapses. And sort of a similar result was found when they used a GABA-A antagonist. So the ideas that came out from these experiments are sort of shown here. And Mori and his colleagues have argued that these dendrite-dendritic circuits, in particular the lateral inhibition that they mediate, is important for refining odor discrimination. And that just comes from sort of the following model. You can imagine, let's say, 3 sets of mitral cells that are each tuned to an individual subset of olfactory receptors, so that any of the mitral cells that project to glomerulus A would be most strongly excited by the odor compound, in this case with a short carbon chain length. You can imagine the mitral cells that innervate glomerulus B are more strongly excited by those of the middle carbon chain length, and then the mitral cell C over here would be excited maximally by the longest carbon chain lengths. And if we were to just look at the output of this one individual mitral cell that goes to this B glomerulus, because of these lateral interactions here between the cells, what you can imagine is that you actually get a sharpening of the tuning of the mitral cells that respond to these middle odors because of this lateral inhibition.
The last week's speaker argued against this.
All right.
So what was the argument against it? I mean, I understand that because, so Gilles Morel believes that it's conversion of spatial code to temporal code.
Mm-hmm, sure.
But what's his argument against this experiment?
Right. So now let me.
The argument was that this would induce more sparseness, and there was no change in sparseness.
He said, if you block inhibition, there's no change in sparseness.
No, in time.
Yeah. So clearly, look.
You could kick in much faster than
Clearly, the world of olfaction now is sort of divided into two camps, and one camp has a Gilles Laurent as its leader, all right, in terms of temporal coding. And then there's a lot of the people, which generally came from the, put forward by all the molecular biologists, are the spatial map people, and now a lot of people doing the in vivo imaging. You know, one could always argue, you know, which one is the right method at this point. And I think that's ultimately what's going to come out, that both are going to be coming together at some point. And I don't know Gilles Laurent, and I've never met the guy, but I get the sense that he really has, you know, something against a lot of the spatial coding, and I'm just not really sure.
The in vivo imaging is just the in vivo stuff that we showing all these little punctate spots. Has yet to do the most fundamental experiment to my mind, which is demonstrate that this is not simply dominated by presynaptic afferent activity. Mm-hmm. Basically, at this point, if I have to, you know, I'll put my $10 on the table that what the in vivo mapped, the in vivo imaging, intrinsic imaging, is basically recapitulating or just showing us again the spatial map, the receptors coming in, and not showing us the physiology that follows from it. Mm-hmm. Because it's, by its very nature, biased towards picking up metabolism from presynaptic terminals.
Yeah, so Marcus Meister at a Gordon conference just gave a whole, I mean, you might even know of this information more than I have, but a large part of his talk was trying to get at what the signal, and this is from his paper. Actually, so this addressed one of the questions before. In order for this spatial map idea to be important and think about lateral inhibition and odor discrimination being important, you have to come up with a scenario where those glomeruli, which detect related odorants, have to be, you know, spatially close to one another. And this is the argument from Marcus Meister and Bonhoeffer, right? So they've been trying to systematically map out where on the bulbs these the compounds are actually used in that previous study fall. And they argue, well, they do see sort of this mapping of compounds being somewhat close together.
I'd agree that I would expect to see sort of a mapping. And this is, you know, the length of the mitral cell secondary dendrites is hundreds and hundreds of microns. A mitral cell sitting anywhere in the bulb, literally, projecting to any glomerulus in the bulb, can potentially be privy to inputs from any other glomerulus within the bulb. I've always wondered why people get so exercised about the fidelity of the map, the need for glomeruli to be close together, because as soon as you look down into the vault, you discover that everybody could potentially talk to everybody else.
So what's the measurement right here?
This is just measurement of the intrinsic signal activity in the olfactory bulb of a rat. So it's using, you know, the intrinsic signaling stuff where they just flash a red light onto the bulb. And yeah, so what I showed early on was that you could map out, you could visualize presumably individual glomeruli that are activated by odors and sort of showing a combinatorial process of activation there. Oh, but what I was going to say, and I'm going to try and get it straight now if I can remember it, Marcus Meister gave a talk where a large part of his talk was trying to identify what the signal is that they're seeing with the intrinsic signal. And it's one of the things that I asked him, it's just presynaptic activity, so what does that tell you? And he says no. His feeling is that, although you could argue that it is presynaptic activity, and I can't remember the argument now, but I think his point was that it reflects synaptic activity in the glomerulus.
That's presynaptic activity.
How do you know it's presynaptic?
You don't know what's coming out of
the
cavity.
No,
I'm just saying that it's very difficult. You still can't, I mean, I'm playing devil's advocate here. you still cannot, unless you check to see whether the microcell actually made an output, say that just because its dendrite got metabolically activated out there in the glomerulus, mm-hmm. that it had output. Mm-hmm. Because we've seen that the granule cells can gate and hyperpolarize and control the microcells out there in their distal dendrite. So you have to first establish that there's a correspondence between even a depolarization of the distal part of the microcell and its output. Either, the only output that matters as far as the brain is concerned would come from the axon. So,
but they could be using granule cell activity also.
No, that's great.
The synapses, why not this?
The granule cell?
Synapses from the granule
cell. Very unlikely that would be, I shouldn't be taking over your...
No, go ahead.
Very
go
unlikely that they're imaging the granule cells for two reasons. One, the granule cells are much deeper down.
Yeah.
And there's just from the you could talk about the scattering physics of the brain. You can't maintain a spot that's the same size as the glomerulus 200 to 300 microns below the surface. I mean your axial resolution is starting to fall apart. And yet the spots are about the size of the glomerulus that they see here. And that'd be my main argument. Plus as you go down, this is not like barrel cortex, where in barrel cortex you remember that you have these lovely diving I don't know if you had barrel cortex. You talked about. Anyways, in cortex you have a lovely sort of diving architecture to the main blood vessel, so that at the surface you are sampling the metabolism down deeper. In the bulb, it's much more like this. So you don't have the opportunity to sit at the surface and then have a little metabolic signal be relayed to the top.
No, but let's say you're imaging the microcell dendrites, you might be, a lot of the effects
on
the microcell dendrites might be
from the granules. Your granule cells don't make contacts onto these dendrites. The dendrites that are the surface are not the ones.
The wrong dendrites.
The wrong dendrites.
Basal.
And remember that the granule cells make inhibitory connections, which presumably would prevent metabolism from being upregulated.
Yeah, so one could argue about the usefulness of the intrinsic signal imaging stuff. And, you would have to say, there is some work that the work that it's going to give rise to, presumably, is just targeting specific subsets of mitral cells. And I think trying to interpret it without having, simultaneous recording from mitral cells is kind of dicey. But it's all the rage now, that's for sure. So this just gets to this question that was mentioned earlier about this lateral inhibition and how strong it is or how powerful it is. And all that I was just going to show here for an example of how strong it is that it doesn't even require sodium-dependent action potentials. And that's shown in this recording where you just very simply record from a pair of mitral cells into trototoxin, and you just stimulate one mitral cell to trigger glutamate release, and then you look to see what it does in a nearby mitral cell that's not directly excited. So in this case, cell one received a voltage step to cause this dendrodendritic self inhibition. And when we look in the nearby mitral cell, we also see a synaptic current that's time locked to the voltage step that was given to cell one. Both the self inhibition and this lateral inhibition required NMDA receptors, just as we had expected. So what this sort of suggested to us was that this circuit for lateral inhibition is quite strong and, in fact, doesn't require sodium-dependent spiking in the granule cells.
But
cell 2 there, what?
The time course.
How do I interpret that?
Suddenly the time course of the inhibition is very fast.
Yeah, well, I haven't done a lot of this to really make a lot of comparisons about the time course here. I think. Well, I would say that it's somewhat. One could argue here, looking at that trace, that the time course is much more rapid than here. I just don't think from the experiments that we did that this was actually so systematic. I mean, as a matter of fact.
The scale is the same, right?
The scale is all the same here, yeah.
Vertical scale. I think of time, huh?
Oh, the vertical scale is different. Sure, it's much smaller and ampli. I thought you were talking about the kinetics.
Right.
He's talking about the kinetics here. You know, like this is after the wash, and they look fairly similar. There is a slow still, and this is an average of many traces also, and in some cases probably not an average of so many. But the point is that there still is a lot of synaptic events that are coming long after the voltage that we might.
So cell one is being stimulated with a pulse at cell one.
Oh, it's probably like 5 milliseconds long, something like that. So this is, yeah, so the, this is the dendrodendritic inhibition that's actually, this is an average of a number of responses, but basically this reflects GABA release back onto the mitral cell. This is all mediated by GABA-A receptors, and though it's not shown here, this is also all mediated by GABA-A receptors. This response and this response, the self and the lateral inhibition, require activation of NMDA receptors on the granule cell.
So the difference between cell 1 and cell 2 is not, it's just
the first time, up until now, there's been this very striking, and everybody's seen it, long-lasting feedback.
You could argue that if the self inhibition requires calcium influx through NMDA receptors locally, that you wouldn't get it with the lateral inhibition, and that this would be much faster if there's just a transient calcium signal or a calcium potential that propagates through the dendrites very rapidly. Yeah.
How does this depend on distance? So how far is cell one from cell two?
Right. So we haven't looked at that systematically either. All of these, the pairs that we did were on the order of probably less than 50 microns apart from one another, and you would expect, you know, it would drop off as you keep on going. We saw this in about 10% of the pairs that we did. So it's not something where you record from every single mitral cell and you're always going to see this phenomenon. There is going to be something about the connections that are all intact there that are going to make it work.
Do you think these mitral cells are sensitive to in terms of
odors? No, these are all experiments done in slices, so we don't have a nose yet. I'm not sure how long I'm supposed to be going with this talk and whether I should stop now or wrap it up or what. All right.
This kind of reminds me of Lilius, though. Lilius, blood receptors inhibit themselves in chemical synapses, and it's slower than the lateral.
Yeah, maybe I'll just I'll talk a little bit more about sort of these actions of glutamate release from mitral cells, and you'll just have to tell me when to stop because I don't know.
The contact between self-inhibition and lateral inhibition is typical. I think about the otherwise scale.
Yeah, I would say in the cells and the pairs that we saw, the lateral inhibition was always substantially smaller than the self-inhibition. Yeah.
I guess the issue is what's 40 picoamps, how does that compare? That's 40 picoamps of shunting current for the fluoride. How does that compare to an EPSC? I mean, is it, when you ask, is this a significant inhibition? I have a sense of yes, it is, because I have an intuitive feel for the size of currents. 40 picoamps is,
And I have to preface this by saying that everything that I'm showing you today is very mechanistic. You know, it's all looking at sort of the biophysical properties of these synapses, what the receptors are, what's important, and how it might work. But none of the stuff that I'm telling you here, I would say is something to really take back for how the system works for you know, the processing of olfactory information. That's something that we're interested in and trying to move to now. And I think that's going to come from doing, you know, much more physiological work and doing experiments in vivo and patch clamping and seeing what the size of all of these currents are or potentials are and how the lateral inhibition works. But just please bear in mind that this is all sort of a first pass at how the cells and the synapses might be working. And maybe just to give us some clues for what to look for in vivo. So let me just move to another little story about what else the glutamate release does for mitral cells. And that is that it seems that the glutamate from the mitral cells, as well as triggering this dendrodendritic inhibition, also leads to self-excitation. And just an example showing that is going to be on this slide. In these experiments, we use a low chloride internal solution. So now in a voltage clamp mitral cell, and we give a brief voltage step into tetrodotoxin, any inhibitory current is going to look upward. So this is that slow dendrodendritic self-inhibition under control conditions. When we apply the GABA-A receptor antagonist bicuculine, it blocks that slow outward component and leaves this inward excitatory current. And that excitatory current was abolished by the NMDA receptor antagonist APV. This is just a superimposition of the two conductances that were there during that event. And the simplest sort of explanation for this is shown here, that in addition to the mitral cell releasing glutamate onto the granule cell spine, the glutamate can also come out of the mitral cell and activate, presumably, NMDA receptors on itself for self-excitation. And probably the simplest way to think about it in my mind is that, you know, we're talking about sort of spillover here, actions of glutamate at some distance from a synaptic contact. So one can get a little more diabolical here and say, since we know those lateral dendrites of mitral cells are all sort of intermixed in the olfactory bulb, is it possible that the glutamate that's released from one mitral cell could directly excite another nearby mitral cell? And to get at that question, we just did another sort of paired recording, and these are sort of all the conditions here. Again, you know, it's not very physiological. It's just seeing if this circuit could work. It's in tetrodotoxin, low magnesium, so you could really see the NMDA receptors and all their beauty. Picrotoxin to block GABA-A receptors. And the main point to bear in mind is that from a whole bunch of anatomical work in the olfactory bulb, there are no synaptic connections directly from one mitral cell dendrite onto another one, right? So given all those conditions here, in this paired recording, what we're showing is that if we give a voltage step to cell one, we can cause glutamate release from that mitral cell, which causes this inward excitatory current, this self-excitation, which is blocked by APV. However, here, if you look in the nearby mitral cell, which is not directly stimulated, you also see that the voltage step causes an excitatory current that's mediated by NMDA receptors, and it's entirely reciprocal, so that if you stimulate cell 2 now, you see this excitatory current in cell 1. So this actually sort of suggests that you can get this spillover of glutamate between nearby mitral cells. Visualize glutamate receptors on the
dendrites.
Yeah, so there are NMDA receptors on mitral cell dendrites. It's not that the density of the NMDA receptors isn't extremely high. It doesn't look like what you find at conventional synaptic contacts, but they're certainly there on the mitral cell dendrites. So another thing that we seem to see quite often under conditions when we really boosted the ability to see NMDA receptors was that we can see a lot of spontaneous synchronous activity in nearby mitral cells. Yeah.
Can you go back once?
Yeah.
So how strong is this lateral excitation? It's like one disc, right? Did you say there are no synapses?
Yes, there are no. There are no gap junctions that I know of. There are no synaptic contacts.
If you just puff glutamate on, do you get the same? If you puff glutamate onto the
mitral cell, do you see an NMDA current? Yes.
And what you're focusing is on the secondary dendrite, right? Are you is there a reason other than to keep things organized that you're staying careful away from the apical dendrum?
Well, no, it's not careful at all. It's just because it's generally because one could argue, where is this glutamate spillover occurring? And I think that's going to be an issue, probably because Gary Westbrook is going to have a paper coming out saying that a lot of these events that I'm talking about here actually occur in the apical dendrite in the glomerulus. First of all, I would say that this stuff that we're seeing here does not require the apical tuft, because in many of these experiments, it's just been cut off there. So in my mind, a lot of the stuff that I'm showing you here, this spillover between mitral cells that I'm showing, occurs in the absence of any glomerulus.
This is very important, because in the glomerulus, you have groups of mitral cells that are now clustered together, paying attention to the same thing. So
right.
Functionally, that's very different from just random dendrites down.
Right. So this next stuff that I was going to talk about is probably something that's more restricted to cells that converge onto the same glomerulus. And so what I just wanted to show with this is that there can be communication between mitral cells that's excitatory in the absence of any conventional synapse. Another thing that we saw under some of these conditions is that if you just record from two nearby mitral cells, you can see these large synchronous synaptic currents, right? They're on the order of hundreds of picoamps here. And if we just focus in on one sort of set of them, these synchronous events are completely abolished by the NMDA receptor antagonist APV. Again, the cells that we record in all of our pairs in terms of distance, they're very close to one another. They're within 25 microns or so. We pick one mitral cell right next to another one. And the likelihood of seeing this, in terms of how far it extends, we really haven't characterized. That would be a lot of work. So this seemed to be something curious to us. And what we found, and we haven't done this systematically, but this is just an example of one of these mitral pairs where we saw this synchronous activity. I don't know if I can play the movie here. Oh well, didn't want to play. But we would fill our mitral cells with various dyes so we could look at one that's green and one that's red. And this is just an example of one of these pairs that we record from, where you can follow the apical dendrite all the way up to the glomerulus and see that their dendritic tufts seem to sort of superimpose in the same glomerulus.
All right. You had a movie that was going to rotate.
Yeah.
He did escape and then just run it in the actual PowerPoint.
You think? All right. I don't know why it didn't work there.
Now he did escape.
Yeah.
Okay, now let's see if it comes up.
Oh, there, it's going quasi. Now, how do I get back to where I was? Am I screwed now? What?
Slideshow.
Oh, God. But how do I get to the one that I want?
No.
Yeah, great.
Go back up.
This is great.
Go back up.
Back, where do you want me to go?
Escape again and just hit the slide you wanted.
All right, now it's really sick.
Oh, I screwed you up.
Hold on.
You know what the slide was?
Who the hell knows? I don't know. It's this one. Yeah, now I have that. How do I make it go to the slideshow? Oh, hold on. I'll get it in a second. I know I can probably do it from here.
So these are the movement would have showed us that the two apical dendrites are contained within the same glomerulus.
Yeah, look like
but
it.
But they have overlapping territories in space. That parts of their dendrites are actually overlapping within the
yeah,
glomerulus.
Right.
Even though each dendrite doesn't occupy.
It didn't look like it they weren't commingling. I tend to think that it's the same glomerulus, a large glomerulus, but I have no evidence that it actually is.
There you go.
How the hell do you do that?
Well,
Oh, yeah, that'll do it. All right.
Jeff, if you're out the middle of it, you can take a break, or if you're close to...
I could just finish it up soon. I think we've probably heard enough on it. So, yeah, so this is just an example, again, of sort of this synchronous firing that one can record in mitral cells. And then it seems that this synchronous firing is all mediated by NMDA receptors, which could be evidence of some of these lateral excitatory interactions. And why that could be important, let's skip that, waves of activity, and let's just go to the summary slide. So what I've shown you up to now is just a little bit on how this dendrodendritic circuit might work and some of the players. Although we haven't shown it here, we and others carry, probably a million people have shown, that action potentials can propagate through the dendrites of mitral cells. This triggers the activation of high voltage activated calcium channels in the mitral cell dendrites, which releases glutamate onto the spines of granule cells. That activates both AMPA and NMDA receptors. While there are some groups that believe that calcium influx through the NMDA receptor directly triggers GABA release, we tend to think that under normal operating conditions, it's the slow kinetics of the NMDA receptor, which are especially good for bringing the spines and perhaps regions of the dendrites to threshold for activating voltage-gated calcium channels, which drive GABA release. And those calcium channels I haven't showed you are of the N and PQ class. And then just shown over here is some of that lateral inhibition stuff that I was talking about, that if you excite a particular mitral cell, as well as causing sort of this feedback self-inhibition, even in the absence of any sodium-dependent action potentials in the mitral cell, one can see lateral inhibition through the granule cell dendrites. And so that would suggest that a signal has to be propagated from an activated granule cell spine to another spine on the dendrite, which is not itself activated. And to us, the simplest signal that propagates is just membrane depolarization, presumably activating voltage-gated calcium channels on that spine as well for the lateral inhibition. And I think I'll just stop there for today. Yeah?
Let me try to get you. So the time scale here, the self-inhibition is coming from, you're saying it's from the NMDA receptor or the calcium channels?
Well, neither. Neither. All right, so it turns out that if you look very closely at the kinetics of these sorts of responses, and some of the stuff that I think you may have missed in the beginning of the talk, the time course of this dendrodendritic self-inhibition at near physiological temperatures has a decay time constant of about 250 milliseconds. All right, the time course of decay of an NMDA receptor current in a granule cell is significantly faster than that, on the order of, you know, maybe 100 milliseconds, all right? And what I also showed is that we can drive this dendrodendritic circuit in the absence of NMDA receptors when we just slow down the kinetics of AMPA receptors a little bit. And in those conditions, when we slow the kinetics of the AMPA receptor, we're going from about 1 to 2 milliseconds under normal conditions in the presence of this drug cyclothiazide that we put on, it slowed down to 10 milliseconds. So in my mind, you can't specifically match up the kinetics of this dendrodendritic inhibition, which is very slow, to any of the underlying kinetics of the synaptic currents. And so in my mind, it's got to be something else. Now, you know, one could argue that maybe it reflects the time course of calcium in a dendritic spine after the calcium has come in through an NMDA receptor. I think that's somewhat unlikely. Particularly given the fact, you know, I mean, it's not such a great argument, but in all the times when we've triggered dendrodendritic inhibition in the absence of NMDA receptors by, you know, putting on blockers of potassium channels or slowing the kinetics of the AMPA receptors, the time course of dendrodendritic inhibition is quite fixed at around this 250 milliseconds. And what I think it's reflecting is some active property of the granule cell, some calcium spike that's going on up there, blah, 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 ringing for a little while. now out there in the dendrites. And that's one of the things that we're looking at now with imaging the granule cell dendrites and trying to do that with a paired recording and see what it all looks like.
So if you made the calcium spike longer, if you interfere with whatever repolarizes after the calcium spike, then you're predicting that it should last
longer. Right.
Would you be here Wednesday or
not? I'm leaving today.
Oh, okay. So, since Jeff won't be here, I'll have you.